speaking from a book industry perspective, what I have realized is that people, it's so siloed, you know, people in publishing and the publishing industry in general seems so siloed from even like bookstores. And then bookstores and libraries seem to have a much more like cohabitative relationship with each other, but are still very like, we don't know how you all operate.
Yeah.
And like, nobody knows, you know, and then you have authors who are doing, you know, they're why we all exist.
Right.
You know,
right?
They're writing the books, but they're out here in the cold. Like, you know, how do I get my book into a library?
What do I have to do?
I don't, you know, and so understanding what happens to a book when it enters the library and then how does that affect, you know,
where it goes
high level,
right?
You know, Library of Congress, you know, all of these, all of this data is out there around the book. How does that impact who's getting,
I love that.
You know, who's getting their eyes.
Who's there?
Who's there? Who's on the shelves? Who's getting visibility? And does the inadequacy of a lot of this, these codes and these rules, does the inadequacy of that affect who can be on the shelf?
Welcome to Book by Book, a podcast from independent children's book publisher Sambasivan and Purik. I'm your host, Leanne, the publishing coordinator for S&P. On this podcast, we feature bite-sized interviews with people from the world of children's books. On this episode, I'll be chatting with Misty Alvaro from the Columbus Metropolitan Library about what it means to catalog books at the public library and why bookmakers should care about it. The next episode will also feature a conversation with Misty, this time about how the history of cataloging impacts what stories get told and what the future of cataloging looks like. Misty did a lot of things before finding librarianship. They worked at an excavating company. They were a tutor and interpreter for Japanese nationals living in the U.S. They were an assistant manager of a goth bar, pastry chef, bead store clerk, pizza delivery driver, and a craft class teacher. They've worked in public, academic, and special libraries in public services, technical services, and training for the last 15 years. Misty is currently the materials manager for Columbus Metropolitan Library, overseeing the cataloging and processing of library materials for the whole system. Columbus Metropolitan Library, or CML, is celebrating their 150th birthday with lots of exciting events this year. They first opened March 4th, 1873, as a single reading room in City Hall. Today, they have 23 locations from Dublin, Ohio to Canal Winchester.
Hi, Misty.
Hi, Leanne.
Thank you so much, and thank you to Columbus Metropolitan Library for having you on the podcast today.
Thank you.
So if you don't mind, would you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. I am Misty Alvaro. I am the materials manager for Columbus Metropolitan Library, and no one knows what that means. So I manage all of the cataloging and processing for all of the materials in the library system.
Okay, great. So cataloging and processing, and you're in collections.
Yeah, so it's collection services is what we call it. The rest of the world calls it tech services, but we're cool and different.
Okay, great. I have a library background, but we're going to approach it like I've never set foot in a library before. When you talk about tech services or, you know, where does your department sit in the library?
Physically, in most libraries, we would be in the basement.
Oh, okay.
So that is sort of the traditional, we are of the basement people.
Okay.
Right? Cataloging is one of those jobs, and processing usually goes with cataloging.
Okay.
It's one of those types of work that becomes invisible very quickly if you do it properly. Invisible labor is major because we are never public facing.
Okay.
If you're in a super duper tiny library, everybody does seven different things. Nobody has one job like I do. So I have a friend, for example, who's the assistant director of her library, and she's also the only cataloger. And she does all the processing and everything. So it really depends on the size of the library, where it lands. Typically, it is support services. That's probably the simplest way to categorize it.
Okay. And what kind of background do you have? And what led you to be a cataloging and a processor? Like, did you go to school for that? Do you memorize the Dewey? What do you need to do that work?
That's kind of a long story because I did a lot of things.
Okay.
And I hit a point where, like, I had been tutoring and interpreting for Japanese families for, like, 12 years or something, and I missed health insurance, right? I missed paid vacation. I was like, wait, someday I might want to retire, maybe.
we don't want to work forever. You know, and
I'd been a bartender, well, an assistant manager of a bar. I had been a pastry chef. I had done all these things, right? And somebody said to me as I was lamenting the options, right? They said, you know, the only place in the world you're going to use all of the weird stuff you know is in the library.
Ah, so true.
So it is. It's really true because I had studied foreign languages. That was really – that's my educational background is in languages primarily. When I got to library school, there are certain required classes in library school. One of them is called Organization of Information. Yes. And it's really your introduction to the idea of how libraries organize their materials. So call numbers or just where we shelve things or how we describe them and talk about them. So in my first class, this teacher said, everyone who can speak and read another language, stand up. And most of us stood up. I mean, we're graduate students at this point. You know, everybody's taken a language. And she says, okay, if it is a European language that is written in Romanized characters, please sit down.
That's going to be and most
so, people. most of the class, right? States, it's like me and one other person who could read Chinese. And she sticks her fingers out at both of us and says, you two are getting jobs. It's like, oh my God.
Whoa.
But when we started actually getting into the MARC cataloging, and MARC is the code that we use for most traditional cataloging in library catalogs.
Okay.
It is a code. It really is. It's not as heavily coded as like HTML or XML or anything, but it is a code.
Yeah.
And it felt just like learning a new language.
Wow.
And it was just this headcanon. I was like, wait a minute. That means I know how to code. I can code. I can figure that out.
Okay.
And so I did. I studied some XML and some other codes while I was in school. Just realized it all fit together really well in my brain.
Yeah.
You know?
Talking about the MARC catalog, which I also have my MLIS, but my background is very different than Misty's. It's yours. And I do not speak that many languages. And I remember the one catalog class you have to take. You know, I think, it's one of the, like, everybody has to take at least one. I remember going through the cataloging class and being like, holy cow, like, I hope I'm never tested on this. I hope this does not come into my day-to-day in the library. And for me, because I was a public services librarian, I was so that means for the listeners, you know, I'm down front on the desk. When you walk in, I'm the face you see. Hey, I saw a blue book on the cover of the New York Times 3 years ago. Can you find it for me on the shelf?
There was a dog in it.
Yeah, there was a dog in it. Can you find it? And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. This is my bread and butter. Best day ever. So when I then, you know, when your librarian that you're talking to on the desk pulls up the record, that's where all that labor you were talking about comes in.
Yes.
So can you talk a little bit, and as much to somebody who hasn't taken a cataloging class, about how, you know, when you talk about, especially in a public library, how the work that you're doing as a cataloger is affecting the findability of resources in the library?
Most people search by keywords. This is a universal truth.
Yes.
It is easier. Right? There are sort of these default relevance listings, right? That are based on, did it find your whole phrase? Did it find all the words? Did it find them in the right order? Right? So that was really interesting to me too, figuring out how to match those things up, how to make sure that this thing shows up when it is the most relevant thing to someone's search.
Okay.
The interesting thing about this is that we have specific areas of a cataloging record. Like some of them we copy exactly what is on the book or the DVD or whatever it is. Some of them we have to choose from a list of terms that have been established by like a national standard setting organization. Mm-hmm. And some of them are just free text where you just get to be a human talking to other humans. And I'm a firm believer that that's how you have to approach those parts of cataloging. Like, I'm a human being. I'm talking to another human being who wants this book. How are they going to search for it? I just get psychic for a minute. Just try to put yourself in someone else's shoes and think about what keywords they're going to use and make sure you have that phrase somewhere in one of those free text fields. I think that's really important.
When you talk about the control lists.
Oh, yeah.
The subject theme. So for listeners who are either already involved in the book industry or, you know, if you're a publisher, when you go to create the book, one of the first things we do when we set out to create, for example, you know, C.S. Bloom or one of our children's books, the first thing you do is you create the metadata. Like the publisher actually sets down
to
do that.
Yeah.
One of the things that I have learned to do was pull up and like the BISAC
code. That's the book industry standard.
Yeah. Okay, book industry standard. I didn't even realize what it stood for.
Yeah, I can't remember
what the rest of it is. But
yeah, they have their own subject heading list. Oh, this is an acronym
heavy profession. But the BISAC codes, which is a list of keywords or like subject.
There's subject terms, but there's a hierarchy to them. So you can go from more general to more specific, right?
Exactly.
There's a structure in there too. So you can say cooking, Asian, Japanese, desserts.
And that's right where, though, we've come across this issue of the list was not made in 2023.
It was not.
And it certainly wasn't made with, you know, the careful, considerate, nuanced approach to inclusivity that, you know, you're doing the work in, and so many people in the industry are doing the work now. So that list was very limiting. We're stuck with these really finite lists. So can you talk about those control lists a little bit? Who created them? Where did they come from?
I love this topic. Okay. So this is why I'm an enormous dork who needs to be doing this work, right? So the idea of controlled terminology goes way back. So the core idea of it is, let's say, you know, there are 364 John Smiths who have been cataloged, and one of their works has been, but they're all different people.
Right.
If we just put John Smith in all of their records, you're going to get way more books than you were looking for if you're looking for a particular John Smith. So what we call it is disambiguating or differentiating the names. So what you put as a publisher on the title page or on the cover of a book, okay, that has its own spot in the record when we're copying from the book. But we also put a controlled term, an agreed upon international standard term for that person.
Interesting.
Okay? And this works not just for authors, but also for people about whom works have been written, right? So like Queen Elizabeth, right?
Yeah.
She has a heading. Dalai Lama has a heading, right? Of course, he's written books too, but they're used in both places,
okay,
right?
Yeah.
The idea is when I search for John Smith, I want the right John Smith.
Okay.
So this also works with subject terminology, right?
Okay.
It's the same thing because I'm trying to think of a good ambiguous word. Covers. That could be book covers. That could be covers of songs.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there are a lot of, it could be bed covers, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many different things. And so we disambiguate things that can be confusing in a catalog. So, you know, when you look at that term, when you see you type something and it says, hey, did you mean this? Or maybe there's a pop-up as you're typing, right? That has that drop down and it says, oh, do you mean covers bedding? Do you mean covers music? And so it really helps people kind of figure out the structure too when they do that.
Yeah.
So these lists, there are lots of them. I mean, I think that's the first part that a lot of people don't realize. Even new catalogers have no idea how many lists there are.
Right.
So we get our core information when we first start cataloging, by the way, we do get it from the same place you do.
Yeah.
So the publisher's database, Onyx, feeds into the Library of Congress.
Okay.
They have a program that takes all of that data, puts it into our code.
Okay.
Right? They use the same information. And that is what we call cataloging and publication data. So it hasn't been confirmed with book in hand at all, but it's a good start, right? It gives us a good idea where we're going with this. And that allows our customers to put holds on stuff.
Interesting.
So we have something to put in the catalog from the publishers.
And so that happens. It goes from the publisher to Onyx to Library of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
That's all kind of in the ether.
That's out there. That's on a database that is
so
available. None of that has controlled terminology. So every time we catalog something from publisher information, we have to figure out which John Smith it is.
Yeah.
Right? Subject terminology, though, goes back to the 19th century.
Wow.
The controlled subject lists at the Library of Congress, anyway, go back to the 19th century. And then we have the terminology that's associated with, like, Dewey decimal numbers. Also, 19th century. Dewey, turns out, not a great guy, you know? So even if he had been a great guy, of the 20th century, that's, you know, there are very different cultural ideas, a very different reality, different language.
Okay, so let's talk about when the book from the publisher hits the cataloger's desk.
Okay.
What happens next?
So,
like, how are you deciding?
So this gets really weird because we developed a new process here at CML during the pandemic.
Okay.
Early in the pandemic, actually. Like, I think I was working on this in May of 2020.
Whoa.
To catalog books without touching them, to catalog them before they ever arrived in our building.
Right.
So, thank you, Internet, because there's a lot of good internal imaging of books that we can use to look at the parts we have to see to have a full, accurate description of a book. We have great summaries. We have advanced reader's copies going out to reviewers from Kirkus who do phenomenal work. I love Kirkus personally as a cataloger because there is a rigor involved in their reviews that I really appreciate. So what we're doing at CML is we're looking at an invoice that has just come into our catalog. Our vendor has said, these books are on their way. Mm-hmm. Here's when they're arriving. Here's the invoice. We look at all of the titles from that invoice and we catalog them using the internet and that invoice, right?
Whoa.
This would not have been possible in the 80s. It literally would not have been possible in the 80s. And it's still like catalogers freak out about it a little bit because they're like, wait, you didn't touch the book?
I'm like,
let's be honest. Does a customer really care if I am using the pagination provided by the publisher or the exact last numbered page? Not usually.
Yeah,
they want the book.
Usually. And I mean, speaking from the publisher's point of view, like all of that information we have available and we have to have it available. I mean, months and months mm-hmm. and months ahead of time. Normally it's, you know, the first thing we do, it's almost like working backwards.
Yes.
You know, you get that information. You have how big the book is, how many pages.
Oh man, we would love to have that up front.
That would
make my life so much easier.
You know, is right up there, especially when, I mean, you know, I'll bleep it out, but Amazon.
Yeah.
You know,
those guys. Those big guys.
When Amazon is in the picture, when you want your books to be, you know, out there, because as soon as the publisher can start selling the book mm-hmm. is as soon as those links go live. Mm-hmm. But for those links to go live, they need the metadata.
Yep. Okay. And the standards for the metadata are really interesting too. So the differences.
There aren't any?
Oh, there are.
Okay. Yeah.
But not so much for publishers. So publishers have a very minimal amount of information they have to provide, right?
Correct.
And you all are looking at things like, how do I make people buy this book?
Yep.
How do I drum up interest in this book? And we are looking at how do we most accurately and objectively describe this book?
Mm-hmm.
So we have two very different goals and motivations anyway. So yeah.
And can you talk a little bit too, I guess, because I think I've thrown around the term metadata a bunch. Mm-hmm. What is metadata?
Oh, that's a great. So if you go to the Greek, it is data about data, right? So it's really interesting. People use the term very differently. So it's any information about something else. It's really it. It's information about something else. When I have a book that is a list of, it's just a bibliography, right? It's about all these other books. That book in itself is a form of metadata, right? It's a book about other books. Catalog records, the code I'm talking about, that's mm-hmm. all metadata. It is information about our resources, okay? A lot of times when we use metadata in the library field, especially, when we talk about metadata, we are talking about things that aren't traditional MARC-coded catalog records.
Okay.
They're not that usual code that we use in catalogs.
Mm-hmm.
But technically, metadata is a broader term, right, of MARC cataloging. So all of our MARC cataloging is metadata, but not all metadata is MARC cataloging.
And the MARC cataloging,
mm-hmm.
That's
the
capital
code.
M-A-R.
Capital M, capital A, capital R, capital C.
That is the data that librarians across the world are writing for every book that comes across, whether virtually or physically across their desk.
Well, it's the code that they are applying to available information about that book, right?
Okay.
So they're fitting it into this MARC framework, into this box, this MARC box, to display it within some very limited catalog systems, right? I mean, this is all because of what our catalogs are. We have to do MARC for you to be able to read it on the other end.
Yeah. And so by reading it on the other end, you mean, you know, customer, patron walks into the library, goes up to that computer that says, hey, check out our catalog.
Yep.
And also the librarians are using that as well, you know, when they go to look for books.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk about how that data, so you're completely behind the scenes. You know, to be clear, you know, if the listener, you walk into a library, you aren't going to see that work being done. Like you said, Misty, they're in the basement, you know.
If you do it right, nobody sees us or thinks about us, right?
Yeah. Why is the MARC important? So for example, if the publisher has already said, you know, we've put the BISAC codes in, we've said, this is a poetry book for children. It is about self-acceptance and self-love. Mm-hmm. And the author is Korean American.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that data is all there. So then it comes to the library. The library adds its classifications and codes, and it adds its MARC data. So why all the hullabaloo? You had said it's a very human thing to look at all these books.
Yeah.
So why aren't you going to lose your job to AI? You know,
that's a great question.
Yeah.
And I love talking about this. This is like one of the core advocacy points in the kind of work I do. MARC, by the way, it's an acronym, of course, because isn't everything. And it means machine readable cataloging. That's its own thing. It's a code, right? But we have to make things fit into it. So when we take publisher information, as I mentioned before, this is about promoting the book, right? This is not about objective description of the book. The subject lists that we have to describe titles are far more robust than anything the book industry uses. There are several of them, in fact. So if you get into specialized topics, right, let's say you have an art library specifically, like at OSU, right? They have an art library. You may choose to use the Art and Architecture Thesaurus, which is a specific list of very granular terminology about art and architecture. And like the Library of Congress subject headings will not have that level of granularity. Every time somebody catalogs a book, though, and there is no term that they can find for the thing, they can suggest one. So, I mean, these lists are constantly growing at an exponential rate, depending on how many people have been trained to do the work, right? So, yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of human analysis that goes into that, then. Mm-hmm. So when we are looking at the data, we're like, okay, but is that enough? Mm-hmm. Will people find it using the information you gave us? Does the information you gave us still match what's on the book? Because mm-hmm. there are title changes, as you well know,
right.
during publication sometimes.
Yes.
Sometimes the way the name of the author is mm-hmm. written on the cover and the title page yeah. changes before right. publication. Totally. So we confirm all that
yeah,
to make sure
I mean,
it's accurate.
Is there something that you wish the publishing industry you know, whether it's actual, you know, like the big three publishers or mm-hmm. what do you want publishers, authors to know if you could leave them with like one kernel about your job?
Oh,
you know,
wow.
about what the importance of cataloging mm-hmm. of everything that we've talked about,
like what they should do
or
to make my life easier.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I have strong feelings.
Great.
On that.
Yeah.
I think the big publishers have spent enough time with librarians that mm-hmm. a lot of them are good at this. And this is how their books get to us. They know where to market them. They know how to market them. They know what kind of bindings we need mm-hmm. in order to trust in the longevity of an item in our collection. Right. And a lot of the newer publishers, right, or these smaller, the independent publishers, don't have the benefit of that experience. Mm-hmm. And they don't have the benefit of that exposure. Consistency, please, in data, on the book itself. Like, you do whatever you want in that publisher data at the beginning end. That really doesn't affect us too much. As long as the ISBN is correct, we'll find it. We'll figure it out. We'll match it up. But when we look at a book and we're cataloging it, for example, having core bits of information that we need makes it easier for us to catalog a book and makes us more eager. We can do these things more efficiently. So we're talking about things like, you know, the title being the same on the title page and the cover and the spine, having those three things match, having the author name, however you present it. You guys don't have to do the authority work. We're here for that. But put the author's name the same way on the title page and the cover and the spine. Give us series numbering. If it's a series, give me a series name, give me a series number. I want publication information. Who published it? Where are they? And what date? When did they publish it? Not when did they print it? But when was that publication originated? When was that edition born? This is the information that we need to do this work efficiently mm-hmm. and therefore to do more of it,
mm-hmm.
right?
And it's that sort of, it's one of the things that's checking the box mm-hmm. of legitimacy.
Yeah, exactly.
When stuff comes through your door or mm-hmm. through, you know, from the vendor.
And there are a lot of people who buy books for libraries, and I am not one of those, full mm-hmm. disclosure. I work with them,
yeah.
but I am not them, who have really negative views of sort of independently published mm-hmm. books,
yeah.
right? Or like self-published works. Mm-hmm. And there's some great information in them. But without the sort of, what's the word, the gravitas mm-hmm. of that editorial oversight of a large publisher, right? Mm-hmm. There's doubt that creeps in for a lot of people. Or mm-hmm. the cover art
yeah.
is simplistic or less polished.
There's a high threshold.
There's a high threshold for book design alone, mm-hmm, right?
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, there are ways to bring content to libraries where you're like, hey, I hear you. I hear that this is something you care about that you're having a hard time getting from the big publishers, because maybe it's not financially in those big publishers' best interest to do all of these little mm-hmm. authors and these emerging topics and people. And we want to hear about that. I mean, we search for that stuff. We mm-hmm. look hard to find independent works that are relevant, that are holes in our collection that we want to fill. You know, if we have a huge Somali population, as we do in Columbus, Ohio, we want books that are pertinent to their life experience. And that is not easy to find, my friend. Like, that's hard. So we want to know about it. We want people to talk to us. We want them to ask us what we're looking for. Mm-hmm. Right? Like what we need. And as a cataloger, consistency, frankly. Consistency.
Yeah.
Do it the same way.
Yeah.
For everything.
Okay, great. We're going to take a quick break.
Oh, good idea.
Yeah.
Again, I'm your host, Leanne, and I'm the publishing coordinator at Sabasavin and Purick, talking with my guest, Misty Alvaro, the materials manager at Columbus Metropolitan Library. Don't forget to check out part two of my conversation with Misty in our next episode, where we discuss how the history of cataloging impacts what stories get told and what the future of cataloging could look like. Find Columbus Metropolitan Library across platforms at Columbus Library and columbuslibrary.org. You can find Sabasavin and Purick at Sabasavin ampersand Purick on Instagram and sabasavinandpurick.com. If you have any questions, comments, ideas for future episodes, or just want to say hi, email me, Leanne, L-E-A-N-N, at modernmarigoldbooks.com. Thank you so much for listening.